Now, a new survey by the Irish League of Credit Unions in conjunction with Spunout has found 40% of third level students struggle to afford their living expenses. 88% worry about money. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Head of Communications at the Irish League of Credit Unions, Paul Bailey. Paul, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Ciara.
That's certainly a significant proportion of any particular cohort, but 40% struggling to make ends meet really does highlight the costs associated with further education.
Absolutely. And we know from previous surveys we've done in this area that every year returning to college or starting college poses a challenge for students and indeed sometimes for their parents who often have to finance them. This is a particularly more difficult year, I think, following the pandemic and that we know the problems with accommodation, for example, it's harder to get. And when there's a scarcity, the price goes up. So students are letting us know that they're struggling to pay for accommodation or just standard living expenses.
And that's on campus and off campus, because I off the top of my head, there are only two certainly universities that haven't increased their fee, their on campus accommodation fees last year, and that's Maynooth and NUI Galway, and they certainly do not account for a very significant cohort of students who would be living on campus. And those who are living off campus are having to battle with people in full-time permanent jobs in order to try to afford some kind of accommodation, and in all probability the accommodation that they may be able to afford or contract may not be of a desirable standard.
Exactly, and we'd also know that people who would usually let out a room to a student in their house, i.e. digs as we know it, they're not doing this now because of the pandemic. They don't want extra people in the house, so that's another, I suppose, avenue closed off. Interestingly, I heard this morning the Queen's University in Belfast is offering students £1,500 sterling to give up their rooms in halls on Queen's University, such as the scarcity of accommodation. So that's an interesting take on it. Actually paying people not to take up the room.
And then in that specific location, it will push those renters out into the wider area of Belfast proper, which will have a knock-on effect onto the rental market there, which I imagine, Paul, is happening all over the country around centres of third-level learning.
Absolutely. I mean, as I say, the scarcity of accommodation is driving the price up and then forcing students either stay at home and commute or, come in remotely to classes, which is not really the third level experience that most students are looking for. Part of going to college is about learning, but also it's about mixing and socialising and having that full college experience. So, it's going to impact on them.
And that's to say nothing, Paul, of the cost of bills. We all of us, when we've been doing our weekly shop over the last number of weeks, have noticed that food costs in particular have gone up. But then you'll have the normal utility costs. You could have additional tuition costs. You could have additional transport costs or materials cost. And I know an awful lot of people, Paul, may say, but sure, why don't you just work? And that might be feasible to get a part-time job if there's one available, if it works with your course. But if your coursework is 40 hours a week, Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, as it is in some instances, that's really not feasible. And also, I mean, what's the point of going to college if you're going to spend your entire free time not studying, not learning, but working in order to buy food?
Yeah, it defeats the purpose. Absolutely defeats the purpose. We know from previous surveys that, some students are working so much that they don't actually attend courses, and that defeats the whole purpose of college. In our current survey, we're finding 71% of students surveyed plan to work part time, and then about 59% looking on support from their parents. So it does. You're right. You would expect a certain amount of part time work to supplement maybe the some of the living expenses or maybe the social life, but to be working anything more than 20 hours a week really defeats the purpose of attending college.
Then you mentioned parents, because this situation has a butterfly effect, really. It is not solely the student that is affected. It is their parents, their families, and perhaps possibly the decision of younger siblings, seeing their older siblings' experience to attend third level at all.
Exactly. I mean, it can have a huge effect on families, on family finances. As you say, the example set by their older siblings for the younger ones. So it's that ripple effect, I suppose, that we don't often think about. You know, we think about a student attending college and, you know, studying and having, you know, the full college experience, enjoying that. But we don't think about the expense behind it and the impact on their families. And a lot of families, you know, support their children to go to college. They want them to have a good education. But it does have a long-term impact on finances.
And the difficulty with trying to resolve any of these issues, Paul, is that they are not confined to the student cohort. Rental issues affect everybody that rents, for example, 12,000 people here in County Kildare. Rising inflation affects everybody. Perhaps the ripple effect might not affect all members of the family, but because these are highly, highly complex issues, there's no simple answer.
There is no simple answer. I mean, we know, you know, recent government figures, we're looking at, you know, facing into 10% inflation next year as we try to recover from the expenditure that was made in the pandemic. So there is no simple answer. But what we do know is that we can support young people in maybe understanding how to budget better for college, you know, how they can understand some financial terms. And this is what we've done with spunout.ie as part of this survey. We've launched what we call the Money on Your Mind series, which is aimed at young people between the ages of 18 and 25, and giving them jargon-free advice and help around managing their money and managing the stress associated with managing that money. So it's a really good series that we launched today. And, you know, people can go on to spunout.ie and, you know, talk to a youth information officer. You just have to go on to spunout.ie/question and they'll get to talk to a youth information officer who can answer some questions and point them in the right direction when it comes to managing their money. Not everybody, and including and especially young people, are good at budgeting. Mm. So if we can help them at an early age, it's a great discipline to have as they go through college and beyond, you know, in managing their money.
Paul Bailey, Head of Communications at the Irish League of Credit Unions, thank you indeed for joining us. I'm joined now on the line to matters completely different by the very patient Sinead Gibney. She is Chief Commissioner of the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission. Sinead, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Ciara. It's great to be on.
We're delighted to have you. We're here to discuss a keynote study conducted by the ESRI but commissioned by the IHREC, and it really does underscore the vulnerability in which lone parent families find in terms of housing. And I want to put this in context for everybody. About 20,000 people are parenting children on their own here in County Kildare. I know the One Parent Family Alliance estimates that number nationwide is 220,000 people, a significant cohort of people, Sinead, whom this study has found are intensely vulnerable in housing terms.
Yeah, absolutely. The headline statistic, I think, from this report is that 53% of all homeless families are lone parents and their children. And that really is very, very stark. They are at an increased risk of finding themselves in homelessness, but also of finding themselves in housing deprivation. So having to settle essentially for housing that they know isn't appropriate for their own family needs and the needs of their children. And lone parents are among many other groups as well, or some of the groups who've also been found to be on the raw end of the housing crisis. So young parents, migrants, travellers and people with disabilities also experiencing a huge amount of disadvantage we're uncovering from in this report.
So the groups of people that we would ordinarily in non-pandemic times understand as being vulnerable have been made more vulnerable in this specific context by the pandemic.
Well, by the pandemic, but actually this information is up to around about the start of the pandemic. So the analysis was done, on data right up to it. So it's really about
the... We have shaken the gremlins out of the system, and the Chief Commissioner of the IHREC joins us again. Sinead, you're welcome back to us.
Thanks so much, Ciara, and apologies for that.
Not at all. You were saying before technology got in the way that this study is more about the general experience of housing of lone parents and other vulnerable groups rather than specifically pertaining to the pandemic.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, we do have some findings relating to COVID and particularly around homelessness. But I suppose what we're trying to do with this report here is set out a range of indicators, dimensions that quantify what we mean by adequate housing. I think when we hear about the numbers all the time, we hear about large numbers of the population who need to be homed or, you know, for whom houses are required. And I think what we're trying to do is say, well, it's more than units, it's more than bricks and mortar. There are certain features that we expect to see in adequate housing. And those are accessibility, affordability, security of tenure, cultural adequacy, quality, and location. And what we found is that these particular groups that I mentioned earlier, lone parents, young people, travellers, and so on, these are the groups who are less likely to see these features in the accommodation that they secure. So that's why we would define them as being on, you know, a disadvantage within the housing experience in the housing sector.
And the disadvantage in the housing experience will have a knock-on effect to every other aspect of an individual's life.
Well, absolutely. I mean, adequate housing is really necessary for the achievement of other basic rights, just like the right to health, the right to family life and privacy. And it's also just central to our quality of life, you know, at all ages and stages of our lives. It also underpins how we can and where we can access home and work and school, which are obviously just so important for our own quality of life. And it allows us to live the life we want to live. It can really define that, you know, the cultural choices we make in our lives and whether or not we can make them by definition the housing that we're in. So it really is such a fundamental human right. It's defined as such in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And it's, I think we need to move beyond in housing policy. We need to move beyond thinking about the units and instead thinking about these dimensions and how they feature for the different groups who we're talking about today.
The enormous challenge, the scale of the challenge in resolving housing supply, housing access difficulties, not only for those mentioned in this study, but for society in general, are vast. One that particularly strikes me, though, as arising from the ESRI study, is rents are rising faster than wages. Lone parent families may not have a traditional wage. They may only be drawing a part-time wage, or that wage may be consumed by childcare costs. So their rental purchasing power is significantly lower than a family that may have two parents where one of them works anyway. So the pool of rental homes that they can access is ever concentrating and ever shrinking.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, that's a core finding within the report, that despite the introduction of rent pressure zones in late 2016, that rents have increased by almost 40% in Dublin and 20% elsewhere. And while rental costs have risen at that rate, the mean earnings are not catching up. So that is a disparity and absolutely disproportionately impacts lone parents, who we found have less than 25% of lone parents report home ownership compared with 70% of the total population. And lone parents have much higher rates of affordability issues, so about 19% compared to 5% of the general population.
What's your key finding? What's the headline for you from this study, Sinead?
Well, I think, I mean, as you've identified, I think the statistics, particularly around lone parents, is really quite shocking to a lot of people. I think that this is a group who are just faced with so many barriers in trying to simply provide a home for their family. But I think for me, the most important thing to take away from this report is really that concept of how we choose as a society to define housing. And I think it's really important for us, you know, the policymakers and the elected representatives, but also as a society, to really start thinking about housing as a right. And we are calling on the issue of this report, as we have done in the past, to enshrine the right to housing in our constitution, which we believe will help move the needle on really kind of defining for the state its role and purpose in providing adequate housing as a societal need.
Sinead Gibney, Chief Commissioner at the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission, thank you indeed for joining us. Joined in studio by our own Paul Power, who is going to share with us the details of a first in the history of Irish radio. Paul, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much.
Would help if I put up your right microphone.
I probably would.
Check that again there.
Okay,
there
now. You've got me now, loud and clear. Yeah, it is. It's pretty unique, Ciara, because it's the first time ever that all 25 stations, independent stations around the country, will have gotten together for the one cause, if you like. And in this case, it's to support the live music industry in Ireland, which has been on its knees, let's be honest about it, for the last 18 months. We're talking about people here who haven't worked, haven't been able to gig, haven't been able to play to live crowds. And we all know all about that. And a few months ago, the IBI, the Independent Broadcasters Association, got together with Hot Press and the BAI Sound and Vision Fund to try and put something together to help out with the Irish music industry. And what they've come up with, and this is the live industry specifically, but what they've come up with is by nominating a month to be Irish Music Month, and that month is October.
And that's going to be a month-long nationwide celebration of homegrown talent.
Absolutely. And it's big because there's a lot of different aspects to it. There's going to be there's a 125,000 and a lot of this funding, all this funding coming from the BAI Sound and Vision Funding Scheme and XL Retail Group, who've come in as independent sponsors as well. But there's a massive radio campaign going on across all of the countries during October, €125,000 worth, which will be an advertising campaign to encourage the purchase of merchandise and music from Irish artists specifically, to try and get people away from just streaming it on Spotify where they don't get paid for it, to buying it off their own websites.
Where they will get paid for it.
Where they will get paid for it. So that's one aspect of it. There are two other aspects of it. The second aspect is that we're going to play loads more Irish music. And I'm really looking forward to that because there's some fantastic stuff out there.
And for a lot of people, these will be artists brand new to them. It's exciting talent.
It is. And they will be brand new. But what I love about this, and this is the third aspect of it, moving swiftly along, as they say, is the a local hero aspect of it, if you like. And how that's going to work is each radio station, ourselves included, are sending out invites. The invites are out there now, as of today. Artists, bands can nominate themselves, can enter, I suppose, for want of a better word, the competition. What we want them to do is to send us in a couple of recordings. We want a live recording, so a recording that's been done in a live setting. We'd love to do it in here, absolutely live.
Oh, yeah.
But unfortunately, due to COVID, we can't. So what we need from them is we need a live recording, a recording that was done in a live setting, a recording that was done in their bedroom, in their bathroom, but it was live with no additional bits added in, no bells
jiggery
and whistles
pokery.
Or jiggery pokery. The second one can be a studio recording. It can be something they've released as a single, something that they're particularly proud of, and they can send that in as well. And then what will happen is when we get all of those entries in, and we're hoping to have absolutely loads of them, we'll whittle that down to five finalists. Mm-hmm. Now, we know that music is an expensive business to make, so each of those finalists will receive €700 in expenses, each of them, once they get to that final five. On the Irish music scene with Owen Beatty, Owen's going to talk to all of these artists. He'll be playing both of the songs. And then what we'll do is we're going to put together an independent panel of people within the music industry, people who know more about what they're talking about than I do, to listen to them. We won't tell them who the bands are. We won't tell them who the artists
they're
are.
They're listening blind, essentially.
Let them listen blind. That's the way we'd like to do it. And then tell us who their favourites are. And then we'll obviously have one person to send forward to the grand final from County Kildare, together with all the other 24 stations and ourselves. So that'll be 25. So you'll have 25 finalists who are all going through to a really big national event that's going to happen later on in the year. It's going to be a live event. It's going to be streamed. And the eventual winner of that will receive €5,000. But it's much more than that.
Absolutely. Paul, two really small bits of housekeeping, if you don't mind. What email address do people contact us on, and what's the closing date?
Yeah, the closing date is the end of September. What we would like people to do, and there's one more important thing I just want to say after this, what we would like people to do is send their submissions to us at info@kfmradio.com. And the real important thing here is we want to be as inclusive as possible. So this is open to every single genre of music. If you think you're not cool enough to enter this, you are. So it can be country, it can be traditional, it can be rock, it can be pop, it can be rap,
spoons, aficionado.
It can be anything. We don't mind panpipes, whatever. So it's wide open to absolutely everybody. So just because you're a country singer and you would think that maybe Hot Press, who are one of the partners in this, are predominantly a rock magazine. That's not the case. This is home to absolutely everybody. So, and as well as that, it's not just new artists. Anybody can enter. So we've got some great talent here. Picture this, Jack Lukeman, Christie. If they want to enter, they can. Do you know what I mean? It's open to absolutely everybody, as well as new bands.
As broad a church as humanly possible. KFM's programme director, Paul Power, thank you indeed for joining us. I'm going to turn attention now to a very patient Tanya Ward, Chief Executive of the Children's Rights Alliance, who's been waiting on the line for us there. Tanya, you're very welcome to the programme. Let me see if Tanya is there. Tanya, you're very welcome to the programme.
Can you hear me?
I can. Loud and clear. Great. You're raising again because this issue just does not seem to be going away. It does not seem to be improving or resolving. The fact that children with special needs are being denied their constitutional right to education because of reduced timetables. For families, Tanya, who are lucky enough never to have heard of a reduced timetable, what is it?
Well, it's a situation where a child might be put on a reduced school day or a reduced week over a period of time. And normally this happens in response to, let's say, the needs of a child. The school can't cope, or the school doesn't have the resources, or the teacher perhaps can't manage the child's behaviour. And actually what we know from a lot of schools is that some schools don't use reduced timetables at all, and actually they develop the capacity and skills to be able to work with children from different backgrounds. And this is affecting children with disabilities. So we know there seems to be maybe, if you see some studies, it could be something like 30% of children with autism might be impacted by this. Traveller children, children experiencing trauma, disadvantaged children have all experienced this. And it has major repercussions because while there might be situations, let's say, where not being in school the full day is in your best interest. And you can imagine some children might be very sick. They might be trying to reintegrate them. Maybe they're a refugee child. They've arrived into the country and the school is trying to reintegrate the child. What we know is that there's a large number of children that are on reduced timetables for significant portions of their education. And we have a case in the Children's Rights Alliance where a five-year-old was placed on reduced timetable in junior infants. And that's not an isolated case. And the implications of that is, look, you're never going to achieve your full potential if you're not even getting the school day. And we know when we talk to children and young people who experience this, you know, they feel excluded in the school. You know, they often miss out on forming relationships because they're just not there with the other children maybe during the lunch break. And sometimes they feel that there's a stigma attached to them because they're not there for the full day. Now, we know that the government is planning to publish guidelines, and that will, for the first time, oblige schools, if they are considering this, to think about other alternatives, and they have to get the consent of parents. But the other piece is they should be thinking into the future how to reintegrate the child. I mean, it's very welcome that there's guidelines coming, but it is just a first step in dealing with a very complex issue.
I have to be honest, Tanya, I have like zero experience in the educational sector. So any teachers of children with additional or special needs listening, feel free to roll your eyes at what I'm about to say. It does seem that there might be a significant proportion of cases where children are put on reduced timetables for the convenience of those managing that particular classroom, either because they don't have the resources to cater and support that child, or they need to take their attention away from that child to focus on the others in the building.
That they will be some of the underlying reasons that you would hear why it's actually happening. You know, schools are crying out for resources, and especially, you know, specialised resources for children with different needs. So that's definitely part of this equation. Sometimes we've heard, and this is in the minority of cases, but sometimes we've heard from traveller groups that are saying that they've been sometimes automatically just put on reduced timetables. And it's because the expectations are so low of them that they would want to go on to education and to second level and to third level. And other times we've heard, you know, sometimes it can be, it's just one teacher in the school that mightn't be able to respond to the complex behaviour of the young person, but the other teachers are well able, and it might just be one class. So there seems to be a whole range of things happening within school life. But to be honest, I mean, I heard about this for the first time, the Children's Rights Alliance, 9 years ago, and I was kind of shocked. It was a travel organisation, and they were asking me, would the children's referendum address this issue? And I said, what's your issue? And they said, well, the traveller children in my area, they only get 3 hours a day in school. And I said, well, why is that? And they said, well, the school says they can't cope. And I was like, sure, that's unlawful. There's nothing in law that allows the school to tell you you shouldn't be there for the full day.
But also in that specific instance, Tanya, I would strongly question what the school was saying it can't cope with.
Yes, that's right. That's it exactly. It's just completely unclear what the underlying reason is. And it's very strange. And it's a group of traveller children that are experiencing this. But the other thing that we're hearing is from parents. You know, sometimes parents are saying they're just being informed that this has happened to their child. Other times their consent is sought, but what is said to them is, if you don't agree, your child is going to be expelled or suspended from the school. Mm. And sometimes they feel that they have to agree to it. And sometimes, you know, your parents, they might have completed a third level education or maybe even second level, and you have a middle class teacher who's telling them this is in the best interest of their child. And in their gut, they might know what's wrong, but they might find it difficult to challenge that. And this is all part of this equation. We do need to equip teachers, parents, and how to, you know, address this when it does come up for their child, but also for children and young people as well. We need to educate them that this isn't part of a normal school day. Mm. This should be happening in very exceptional circumstances for a very short period of time. It shouldn't be part of your education experience.
Well, Tanya Ward, Chief Executive of the Children's Rights Alliance, thank you as always for your time.